So this evening is the last evening of my stay here. It's been a bit short, but very eventful stay. And revisiting Wat Buddha Dhamma. I was here in 2001. On a retreat also, but I wasn't giving it. I was joined a retreat. But it's quite fortunate for all of us to be able to come across the Dhamma, the practice of the Buddha's teachings. It's not so often that we have the opportunity. I mean, if you could reflect back through your life, you probably might notice, just a number of different events coming together that perhaps all coalesced that you were actually able to come here and practice. And then we're quite fortunate that we have the opportunity in our own country to practice, rather than need to go to another country or have to face difficulties of a foreign language. At the same time, of course, each one of us needs to be able to apply these teachings to our own particular body and mind. Even though the Buddhist teaching came from India, came from Asia, it really is a universal teaching for human awakening. And only if each one of us can actually practice that, it makes it livable, it makes it viable, wherever we are, beyond country, beyond time, beyond individuals. There are many different ways we can actually practice the Buddhist teachings. Meditation is the real heart of it. It's helpful, of course, to know something about the formal teachings, because it's a bit like having a roadmap. If we haven't got the roadmap, I mean, we probably can find our way around, somewhat. But maybe we also spend a lot of time beating around the bush or getting lost in the bush. In the early days, of course, the only access to the Buddha's teaching was through the books. There wasn't too much emphasis on meditation, or there weren't any qualified meditation teachers around. And maybe even some of the early students of Buddhism didn't even recognize the value of it. Since they come from a scholastic or more academic tradition, they thought that was enough to just learn about it. But now, in developing meditation practices, especially people in the West, these teachings have been practiced in Asia for thousands of years, at least the time of the Buddha in India, maybe 1,000 years in Thailand. And the teachers have had quite a bit of experience with their own mind and maybe teaching other people in their own culture. And we come to the Western culture, quite a different mentality, a different a way of understanding themselves, approaching meditation. And for example, I think many people approach meditation as a kind of a technique. And that's why I think in the early days of meditation practice, the technique-orientated traditions were quite popular. But now, after several decades of people practicing, they begin to recognize, first of all, that the techniques are quite limited. Many of them were actually developed within a Buddhist culture. And they just assumed that people already had a grounding or a basis of Buddhist culture of, you can say very simply, dana and sila, generosity, morality, before they come to meditation, bhavana. And then, now it comes to the West, and many people, they go right straight to bhavana, meditation, perhaps without a lot of grounding in practice of generosity and morality. It's interesting that maybe over the many decades now of practice, people are kind of recognizing the value of these qualities. First of all, they just took up the meditation as a mental exercise, mental training. And then after some years, they recognize something's missing. There's some kind of heart quality or some other element which kind of fills out our practice or actually grounds our practice in everyday life or everyday attitudes. It's not just a mental exercise we do, like mind training or something. That's one part of it, but it's not quite enough. And nowadays, with quite a few meditation teachers living in the West who have a lot of experience with their own practice and maybe teaching students as well, we're on one hand, we're fortunate to have quite a variety of approaches. At the same time, it can be a little bit confusing because different teachers say different things. I remember meeting somebody in Bangkok, and they were telling me about how many different meditation teachers in Thailand, and they ended up getting very, very confused. Because each teacher they went to said, well, this is the best technique, and this is the best technique. And the more teachers they visited, the more confused they got, because there's so many different techniques. But I just reminded her what the real purpose is. Calm and insight. So there's quite a variety of different meditation objects or techniques for calm meditation, and insight meditation. And on one hand, it can be helpful to find a technique or meditation subject which is somewhat we have some affinity with or suits our temperament. But we really don't need to, have to actually use all of them. Especially in the beginning, it just gets more confusing. Take up one which we feel some familiarity with or affinity with and just see how it goes. Because the real purpose of spiritual practice, I say, is actually going deeper into ourselves, not just spreading our practice over a great variety of different exercises or techniques on the outside, but finding depth within ourselves. And now we have some knowledge about these basic principles, calm meditation, using a meditation object to focus attention. And some of the teachers, they emphasize quite a bit of calm, and sometimes even as almost as an end in itself, because probably for some of us who aren't very maybe gifted or talented at that, we could develop calm meditation for the rest of our life and still have lots to do. But in the Buddhist teachings, it's always in the context of calm insight. So we need to keep in mind or keep in perspective, the calm is there for insight meditation. And especially if we're seeing it within the context of the complete path of spiritual practice, the Eightfold Path, we also need some right understanding, right attitude, as well as a moral basis. Maybe at first we can kind of skip over the moral basis sometimes to get more refined states of mind, but if you want to sustain them, it needs to be grounded in a way of skillful living as well. And of course, the refinement of mind also kind of brings into consciousness or brings into the spotlight. The things we do and say reverberate through our mind. And then the right understanding, the right aspiration or attitude. Sometimes these are just looked upon as a bit intellectual exercises, but if we match them up with meditation, then they become a contemplation. For example, the right understanding in its simplest form is understanding the Four Noble Truths: suffering, the cause, cessation, and the path. So we get it in that perspective, then it gives us a certain, you can say, a context for developing calm and insight. Calm meditation as a basis for understanding, deeper inquiry, deeper investigation of the Four Noble Truths. I know that many people, especially then since meditation has become such a popular word and people become more familiar with it, sometimes the calm meditation is used for stress release. One teacher translated dukkha as stress, but it's not, you know, it's not really resolving suffering, it's just releasing it. So if you have some discomfort, some stress, and you develop calm meditation, focused attention, and then stress goes away. The problem is that only temporarily, then we go back to our stressful states of mind, or stressful attitude, or stressful behavior, and it pops up again. So it's not just for stress release. Calm meditation is really for the purpose of giving clear state of mind and a stability of mind to actually investigate suffering. What is it? And so I recognize now that, at least in the early days of my practice, I was actually using calm to escape from suffering. When the mind got calm, then there was very few disturbing thoughts, worrying thoughts, frightening thoughts, etc. So it seemed that all the problems had gone away. But invariably, as soon as I let go of the meditation object, they all came back again. So, back to the breath again. It seemed to be kind of an endless cycle, you know. But then I realized that actually, it's not a matter of just escaping temporarily from suffering. But one actually has to turn this calm mind and this mindfulness, awareness, this attentiveness to this very suffering. Very nature of it, investigate the very nature of it. Which, you know, in kind of a logical explanation sounds a bit masochistic even, doesn't it? You know, look at the suffering. If you only think that way, then it even sounds impossible. And it is impossible just intellectually. But when the mind is calm and we develop more mindfulness with regard to the bodily sensations and feeling tones and states of mind, this gives us a different context for it. Gives us, as it were, kind of a holding context now. Calm can reduce and even kind of calm down the reactiveness, the familiar reactiveness to suffering. Clarity can give us another deeper perspective on it. Mindfulness, awareness. What is this suffering anyway? Normally we're only relating to it from our old stories, our own history about it. And so the mind is spun off into the same old patterns again, the same old reactive patterns. But with the calmer mind and more clarity, we can actually go into it and begin to see it differently. Just even investigating physical discomfort, if you can really look at it, investigate it, you see something different. You see more energies than just this hard, contracted pain. You see different energies flowing in the body, or not flowing. And in the, I don't know if you know the morning chanting in the English translation, but actually you recite the various forms of suffering in the morning chanting, and it's reduced down to the five groups of grasping, panchupadana khanda. We come back again to body, feeling tones, and there's also perception, mental formations, sankharas, consciousness. It's the grasping of these, the contracting around them, the holding on to them, objectifying them, that is the real fundamental source of suffering. Now, how can we actually see that process? It just goes on and on and on, because these five khandhas are what makes up the body-mind. This is what we naturally assume is myself, since we're born, or since a sense of self developed. We just identify with that quite normally, quite naturally, but without question. And then there's the suffering compounded from that. So, as we can see how the grasping of that is actually the source of all the compounding of suffering, we just go with it. That's what the really habit formations are. The whole identification with myself, identifying with these expressions of self. So once we have the right approach, and we get the meditation practice within the right context, then hopefully it will begin to develop, and we begin to actually get a sense for it. It becomes a way of living, a way of being. I know a lot of people, they just talk about meditation as something extra at the end of the day. You know, I did my sitting, I did my meditation. But the real purpose is meditation happens all the time. More correctly speaking, we've done our meditation exercise for the day. But I define meditation as happening by itself. Meditation is not something we can do. We can do the exercises, but we can't do meditation. Meditation happens to us when we have the right attitude, when we have the right experience, the right understanding. Then it just begins to unfold quite naturally, outside of any ego control. So we can't meditate. Meditation happens when we aren't there, or the sense of self has been attenuated to some degree. And these processes, these spiritual powers then begin to function in our life. So at a certain level of practice, you know, it is to do with, there is some element of doing, because we still have ourselves. So I can still develop the quality of focused attention, develop mindfulness, spiritual powers, mindfulness, concentration, faith, wisdom, energy. I can develop them to a certain degree, but there comes a point when we have to let go of them. We have to allow them to kind of take us over, become bigger than ourself. Otherwise, there's still an ego there which is manipulating it. Me who has concentration, me who's mindful. And that's not real mindfulness. That's not real full presence of mind. But if we understand the principles of practice, you know, it's a bit like learning how to swim or how to ride a bicycle. You kind of, you know, try a bit of this and try a bit of that, and try and get some exercise, get some practice. Mm-hmm. And if we have enough continuity, enough faith, enough confidence in the practice, we begin to notice it coming together. We get some proficiency in it. And when there is some proficiency, I mean, we have to be careful it doesn't become just a blind habit. Yeah, yes, that's a bit of a danger always in spiritual practice, that it just becomes an empty ritual. It's something we do just perfunctorily, but that's why I always suggest that when we say, take up the sitting practice, for example, to bring attention to the body sitting here. To actually wake up to this present moment. What's the body sensing right now? What's the sensation of the body? Not like it was yesterday. You can sit in the same posture, but different body there. Your legs are crossed in the same way, but it's a different body. Different mind. So if we actually bring awareness to that body and mind as it is in the present moment, then we are retuning. Even you don't kind of do anything obvious. I mean, you don't do anything, change your posture somewhere else, but just the awareness of that. Awareness and wisdom comes in. And then a kind of intuitive wisdom sets in that I see the body like this, so this is how I should relate to the meditation object. And it's fine-tuned to this particular experience right now, not the habit yesterday that we got used to. And also a really important point, too, is that many people I find, I'll do it myself, we're meditating to return to some great experience we had before. You know, at one retreat I gave I think it was in Switzerland, and somebody, a regular meditator, wanted to come on the retreat, and he asked if he can bring his girlfriend. And normally I wouldn't do that, because it's like somebody's being co-opted onto it. They don't want to be in the retreat. They're coming for their boyfriend, not the retreat. So it's not a good start. But he did say she was interested. So okay. And as it turned out, kind of quite funny anyway, because he was the experienced meditator, and he didn't have a very good experience there actually. A lot of hard work and not much benefit, but but she came on the retreat, and because she had beginner's mind, she had a very, very powerful experience. And then the next year she wanted to come back again. And I warned her, I said, be careful, you're not trying to just replicate last year's experience. Oh yeah, sure, I know all that. But at the end of the retreat, she had a miserable time because she didn't realize how unconscious that desire was. Yeah, she had a positive experience one time, and so she wanted to come back and relive it again. So sometimes we can get caught in that trap rather than sit in the present moment and let it unfold quite naturally. Now, I think it's in the Zen tradition, they talk about the beginner's mind, which is, I think, a very useful thing to be reminded of. And every time they come and sit, it's a new beginning. And this could be facilitated by bringing our attention to the body and the mind right in this particular moment. And also maybe a helpful attitude is one of discovery. Kind of open the mind to just see what can be discovered. Again, a mind of exploration. In a way, this is, to me, the opening for insight meditation. Trying to see anew. See in the present moment. Vipassana literally means to see clearly. So it's another way of seeing, but clearly. What's there? Right now I can see, but not clearly. So we have a more of an attitude of trying to open up that, more clearly. This attitude of a fresh mind, an open mind, an exploring mind. And this is really what the present moment is about. It is unknown, totally unknown. And we think we know all what it's going to be like. And, there are general patterns, probably no big surprises, but actually it is totally unknown what the next moment will bring. This body and mind is, it's in a way, it's a real miracle. We just think we know what's going to happen, but it's in actuality, it's a total surprise that we keep going, we keep breathing, and that the brain keeps working. So important, I think, is the right attitude, sometimes translated as the right thought, right attitude, right aspiration. And aspiration, the first quality is relinquishment. Learning to relinquish the past, relinquish old fixed habits. Technically, of course, it's nekama, which is really without sensual desire. And I think in a wider sense, there is, different levels of desire. It doesn't mean it has to be kind of really empowered desire, but We're desiring to have some stability, have some constancy, or have some desire to know and at the next moment. Even though it is the unknown. And there's also non-ill will and harmlessness as a right attitude. This can be helpful sometimes to reflect, because I know some people have a very harmful attitude to themselves. You know, if their mind is not behaving the way they think it should be, they beat themselves up. You gotta meditate harder. You shouldn't be thinking those thoughts. You should have more calmness of mind. Mindfulness is, that's the way it is. And sometimes just noticing, really being really honest and humble enough to recognize that's the way it is, it changes. You can just drop it without beating yourself up. It shouldn't be this way. And then, of course, as our meditation practice develops, it can be helpful to reflect, to go back again and again past through these different factors. The Eightfold Path, for example, to reflect upon them again, review them again, review like in the chanting, the five khandhas, body, feeling tones, perception, sankharas, consciousness, because we have a different understanding of them. Our understanding can deepen and deepen the more we actually bring our attention to it and bring our inquiring mind to it. So we get a deeper, more wise and deeper wise approach, wiser understanding of what these things really are. And while on one hand you can say maybe it just becomes, maybe some people are a little bit, lazy to think about them. Because, it's more thinking then. What's the sanya khanda perception? My mind's thinking rather than being on the breath. But actually, if you don't have a skillful thing to contemplate, probably your mind is on your own personal thoughts most of the time. Rather than contemplating, investigating, as it were, giving a little bit of a perspective. Rather than thinking, this is a sankhara. This is a mental activity going on, rather than thought. Hearing a sound and start thinking about what that sound is about, it's just perception. Just hearing. And you make your assumptions about it, perceiving it, cognizing it. Rather than worrying about the bodily sensations, will my knee hold out? Just sensation. Turn your attention to this general quality, this more depersonalized quality, rather than my sensation and I'm hearing and my thoughts. So the Buddha's teaching has quite a bit of richness to it. Important that we have a good foundation in the practice. Meditation practice, for example, in particular, that we can actually make use of the Buddha's teachings. Otherwise, it's just a lot of information and interesting things, but just information, rather than themes to contemplate, directions for investigation, deeper inquiry into the true nature of reality. The more that we begin to investigate the Buddha's teachings, the more we come across the real truth of the Buddha's teaching. It becomes more of a direct insight for us. As we investigate the sensations in the body, we begin to see impermanence. They're always changing all the time. They aren't complete. They aren't perfect. And sometimes we can see non-self. They just happen. I didn't plan this particular sensation. I didn't make it. It just happened, part of the bodily process. And somebody was telling me the contemplation on non-self. This is really a very advanced practice. And then she was complaining about all the wandering thoughts in her mind. And I said, "Well, that's non-self. All those wandering thoughts. Do you make them? Can you control them?" That's non-self. That's not yourself there. It's just conditions. If you can control them, that's yourself, but you can't control them. So there's a direct experience of non-self right there. You know, these qualities, the characteristics, the impermanence and unsatisfactoriness and non-self, they're the ultimate nature of reality. They're here all the time. The truth is here all the time. It's just a matter of attending to them, being aware of it. It's happening all the time within our body and mind. And being reminded of it, and then having these particular tools that we can actually create the right environment so that clarity can wake up to them, supports that deeper inquiry. So we're very fortunate to be able to have the Buddhist teachings available to us and have an opportunity to practice, especially in an ideal situation like here, Wat Buddha Dhamma. Very peaceful, very few distractions. All the necessary facilities are here. We just need to bring our own energy to it and keep up with it, so we can actually begin to recognize and maybe see for ourselves how the Buddhist teaching becomes a way of life, becomes a living message, a living teaching, and not something in the library or something we're, you know, just remember occasionally, but it's something which we're actually living, breathing, working with. Not only is it a benefit for ourselves, but it's a benefit for the whole society and hopefully the whole world eventually. So I wish you the best of your practice and continuity in the practice, and then you begin to see the results for yourself. As the Buddha said, there's a teaching to be realized each person for themselves. So the teachers can give you encouragement and guidance, but it's really up to each one of us to put the teachings into practice, and then you'll see the results. Then you become a living example, living expression of it. So I think I should pause there this evening. Wish you well in your practice, and I'll see you in the morning. Mm-hmm.